Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and thanks for joining me today. I'm Andrew McDermott. On this episode, I'm reading for you the afterword to Michael Ashleman's new book, The Restoration of Man, C.S. Lewis and the Continuing Case Against Scientism. It's a newly revised and expanded edition of Ashleman's celebrated study, originally published in 1983, and is newly published in English by Discovery Institute Press. Dr. Ashleman is Professor of Anglophone Culture at the University of Italian Switzerland and Professor Emeritus of Education at Boston University. On other episodes, I'll speak with Dr. Ashleman about his book, but today I'll let the book speak for itself. C.S. Lewis is best known for his Narnia tales and Christian apologetics, works that have sold more than 100 million copies. But Lewis was also a professor at Cambridge and Oxford. An intellectual giant, he fiercely and extensively critiqued the fashionable dogma known as scientism, the idea that science is the only path to knowledge, and matter the fundamental reality. Ashleman's The Restoration of Man ably surveys Lewis's eloquent case against this dogma, and situates him among the many other notable thinkers who have entered the fray over this crucial issue. Ashleman shows why Lewis's case for the human person as more than matter, as a creature with inherent rationality and worth, is a precious resource for restoring and preserving our culture's sanity, wisdom, and moral order. Again, this is the afterword to the new edition, and I've made a few minor adjustments to the text to make it more podcast-friendly. Enjoy! More than a half century after his death, C.S. Lewis remains one of the best-selling writers in the English language, and continues to attract readers around the world. Lewis's argument against scientific reductionism and nihilism is now a matter of concern among a wide range of scientists, philosophers, moralists, and humanists. In their fine, widely used anthology and college text, Philosophy and Technology, Carl Mitchum and Robert Mackey present a substantial portion of Lewis's Abolition of Man, alongside selections from Lewis Mumford, Jacques Ellul, Richard Weaver, George Grant, and Hans Jonas, among others. In recent years, numerous distinguished scientists and philosophers have made virtually the same argument that Lewis did, often explicitly condemning the dynamic scientistic nihilism that Lewis rationally dissected in philosophical works such as The Abolition of Man, and satirically depicted in That Hideous Strength. Noteworthy among such critics have been Nobel laureate brain scientist John C. Eccles, molecular biologists Erwin Chargaff and Günther Stent, psychologist Viktor Frankl, Nobel laureate poet Czesław Miłosz, political philosopher and historian of ideas Alan Bloom, literary historian Erich Heller, computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum, linguistics expert Noam Chomsky, historian and philosopher of science Stanley Jackie, playwright Prime Minister Václav Havel, philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, and sociologists Daniel Bell, Peter Berger, and David Martin. It would be hard to assemble a more impressive list of contemporary intellectual authorities, and the list does not even include spokesmen for religion, such as Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, who devoted his 1988 Fisher Lecture at Cambridge University to a defense of natural law. Even some apologists for science who had previously given short shrift to worries and criticisms such as those of Lewis have apparently had second thoughts. In his recent Science and Anti-Science, Harvard historian of science Gerald Holton made a salutary point. The term anti-science can lump together too many quite different things that have in common only that they tend to annoy or threaten those who regard themselves as more enlightened. Holton here briefly but deftly identifies what biologist David Ehrenfeld calls the arrogance of humanism, meaning naturalistic humanism. By contrast, the basic arguments and beliefs of traditional humanism, Christian humanism, have always constituted the core of Western civilization, to the extent that it has been a civilization and not merely an aggregate of competitive, ruthless, domineering individuals, institutions, groups, or nations. The vanity of reason, unhinged from ethics, was apparent to St. Paul. In 1 Corinthians 8:1, he tells us that knowledge inflates, but charity edifies the human person. And in our century, it has given us what Raymond Aron called the experiences of total war and totalitarianism, in which the human person himself has come to be treated as construction material by technical science gone mad. Concerned as Lewis was with the destructiveness of science without ethics or conscience, what Daniel Bell calls instrumental rationality as a servant to power, he was always aware of a converse danger and temptation. If we are most in danger of deifying science, we can also be seduced into defying it, as does the neo-romantic New Age movement, a variant of the Gnosticism that Lewis understood and opposed in the occult quest of W.B. Yeats and the anthroposophy of his own close friend Owen Barfield. But in the era of cloning, genetic engineering, environmental degradation, technological manipulation, and a contemptibly toxic entertainment culture, the greater, now global, menace is surely the deification of science and technique at the expense of traditional, ethical reason. In perhaps the most important work of moral philosophy published since World War II, Alistair MacIntyre writes in defense of the traditional Aristotelian conception of reason that largely gave us Western civilization in the first place, and whose undermining has brought us to our present confusion. Anti-Aristotelian science sets strict boundaries to the powers of reason, he writes. Reason, so understood, is calculative. It can assess truths of fact and mathematical relations, but nothing more. In the realm of practice, therefore, it can speak only of means. About ends, it must be silent. Thus does a civilization turn into a mere aggregation of competitive individuals and groups. A res publica, such as the United States, turns into a mad, hedonistic, commercial melee. Progress, it isn't. As MIT computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum has written, "This invasive, totalizing, instrumental reason, triumphant technique, and unbridled science are addictive. They comprise an ideal ensemble of tools to serve the non-moral will to power that has been the chief political, social, commercial reality of much of our century." Along with Aldous Huxley and French Protestant Jacques Ellul, Lewis has done more than any other writer of our era to resist this dehumanization, to insist that its logic is not only bad, but false. Harvard philosopher Charles Larmor recently wrote that, basically, Plato was right, because moral value is something real and non-natural. If we do not trust and apply reason in the traditional way deriving from Plato and Aristotle, as mediated by Christianity, then philosophy is only a pretense. Either we must admit that the world is more than the natural world, and that it comprises not only physical and psychological reality, but normative reality as well, or, like the sophists, we must abandon reason for persuasion. Radical nihilists, such as our academic deconstructionists, are happy with the latter alternative. And so are libertarian nihilists, such as our commercial entertainers and advertisers. Both employ highly paid and sophistical ingenuity to loot and ruin our res publica, that body of beliefs, truths, behaviors, traditions, and achievements which is the patrimony of every decent, reflective human being. "Science to go fast, science for enjoyment, science for killing," wrote Leon Bloy 90 years ago. There was a stoic element in Lewis, who knew what combat was, having been a badly wounded veteran of World War I. He could keep his head when all about him were losing theirs, as Kipling put it in If. A civilization is not kept alive and transmitted by absent-mindedness, going with the flow, and popularity polls, by quicksilver intellectuality or narcotic commercial consumerism. It is kept alive by faith, reason, and will, by doggedness and decency. Deny, neglect, or sneer at these normative terms and realities. Deny the full traditional scope of human reason, and you get the nightmare of modern progress. Berkeley molecular biologist Günter Stent notes that the most meaningful contemporary definition of progress can be made from the purview of the will to power. But it is a totally amoral view of progress, under which nuclear ballistic missiles definitely represent progress over gunpowder cannonballs, which in turn represent progress over bows and arrows. This kind of utilitarianism has exercised an enormous appeal in the West ever since Bacon, and now is at the heart of globalization. Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels is one of the enduringly great satirical attacks on it. In our time, works such as the early novels of H.G. Wells, Huxley's Brave New World, Lewis's That Hideous Strength, Walter Miller's Canticle for Leibowitz, and the satirical novels of Walker Percy have augmented a long history of specifically philosophical critiques of utilitarianism's internal contradictions. In his essay, The Decadence of Scientism, Stent argues that the claim of scientism that the positive methods and insights of science are valid for the entire sphere of human activity not only lacks philosophical merit, but is dangerous. And goes on to add that science cannot itself provide a foundation of ethics. But can a perversion of reason that avoids or actively eliminates ethics as a category be called progress to any sensible, self-aware person, especially in the wake of the 20th century? Has such a development not obviously stultified itself? Lewis thought so, and so did distinguished scientists such as Stent, Chargaff, Eccles, and Weizenbaum, the last of whom entitled the final chapter of his book Computer Power and Human Reason, Against the Imperialism of Instrumental Reason. Also arrayed against this impoverished instrumental reason was Pope Benedict XVI, both before and during his service as Pope. As doctrinal prefect of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Ratzinger gave the St. John Fisher Lecture at Cambridge University in 1988, to which reference has already been made, drawing explicitly and at length on C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man in his defense of natural law, and making special reference to Lewis's ecumenical, uninvidious formulation of it as the Tao. After becoming Pope as Benedict XVI, he met with Muslim leaders in Cologne, Germany, warning them of resurgent fanaticism and terrorism as the darkness of a new barbarism. Then, speaking in his native Bavaria, Benedict gave a powerful, widely noted, and tragically and revealingly controversial address in 2006 at the University of Regensburg. In it, he eloquently articulated and vindicated the central, civilizing, rational, ethical tradition of the West and the world, what he called the right use of reason. By quoting the medieval Byzantine Christian emperor Manuel II Palaeologus, in dialogue with an educated Muslim around 1400. Not to act reasonably with logos, the emperor asserted, is contrary to the nature of God. And he insisted that there must be no compulsion in religious matters. Pope Benedict had the privilege of building on the excellent, eloquent, history-transforming work and witnesses of his Polish predecessor John Paul II, so instrumental in the overthrow of communism. In their faithful, judicious encyclicals and ecumenical and international initiatives, the scholarly German and Polish philosopher popes have given us living examples of the transmission of the word without which human life is subhuman and barbaric, and the human experience is without its proper measure. Like his countryman Pope John Paul II, the Nobel laureate poet Czesław Miłosz lived through much of the horror of our century in his native Poland, before emigrating to France and then to the United States. One of the greatest poets and critics of our time, he has written hopefully that he believes the years since World War II have brought home a growing awareness to many people that the dangerous potentialities of unethical, ungoverned science and technology have revealed their finished form not only in the means of massive physical destruction, but also in their ability to pollute the mind. To counteract this pollution, a culture that oscillates between the toxic and the trivial, the culture of the word is needed, not only in philosophy, ethics, and literature at their deepest and best, but religion at its best too. Like Swift, Lewis was neither ethnocentric nor sectarian. His Tao is not his own invention, but the priceless possession of all decent, reflective persons. In the ongoing culture struggle or battle of the books that is modern mental intellectual life, Lewis, along with such writers as G.K. Chesterton and T.S. Eliot, sought to recover, renew, refurbish, and extend the age-old tradition of logocentrism deriving from Plato and the Jewish and Christian scriptures. This tradition has universal scope and significance. As Eliot said, man is man because he can recognize supernatural realities, such as truth, validity, obligation, and mentality, and meaning themselves, not because he can invent them. However, it is in man's power, Lewis noted in The Abolition of Man, to treat himself as a mere natural object and his own judgments of value as raw material for scientific manipulations to alter at will. To do so has surely been spectacularly destructive since Darwin and Nietzsche, but it also involves the human person and human societies in endless rational contradictions and anomalies, dragged demoralizingly down by a pervasive undercurrent of absurdity and irrationalism that deconstructs the very foundations of epistemology and ethics. That polyglot Roman citizen and Jewish Pharisee who became St. Paul told King Herod Agrippa that in his own adult life, he, Paul, had not been disobedient to the heavenly vision that had been personally vouchsafed to him. C.S. Lewis was not disobedient to the more impersonal heavenly vision of the true and the good, which he thought was also offered in some form and to some extent to all sincere persons of goodwill. This integrative, metaphysical, ethical vision is the irreducible, indispensable prerogative, privilege, and patrimony of human civilization itself. No one over the last century has done more to convey, defend, and illuminate it than C.S. Lewis. That was the afterword to Michael Ashleman's newly revised and updated book, The Restoration of Man, C.S. Lewis and the Continuing Case Against Scientism. It's out now from Discovery Institute Press. Get your copy today. Enjoy other episodes of this podcast anytime you want at idthefuture.com. Or you can look it up on your favorite podcasts app. Until next time, I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Join me again soon, and thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.